This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcasts.com. I am happy to bring you today an interesting and different conversation about a book that I hope that you'll check out by my friend Stephen Kent. He is the longtime host of the Beltway Banthas podcast, which looks at politics and the world of Star Wars, and he's written a new book, How the Force Can Fix the World, Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. Stephen is an interesting thinker, a young man who's had a lot to say about the way that we can understand culture and use it to reflect on our humanity and learn different things, take different things away from the experience. I hope that you'll enjoy our conversation. Stephen Kent, coming up next.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and foxnewspodcast.com.
Stephen Kent, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Ben, nice to be with you.
At what point in your life, as an adult man, did you decide that you were going to devote a significant amount of time to writing a book about Star Wars?
Oh my gosh. Well, I respond to market demand, Ben. So when I started sort of treating being a Star Wars fan like a little bit of a hobby sometime around 2016, and mostly because I just needed a break from the turmoil of the political election and something else to occupy my mind with, this was something that I started doing, was just writing and talking about the politics of Star Wars and how different lessons from Star Wars could sort of be applied to how we think about the political world. And the reaction to it was just so strong and has been so strong for 5 years running now, where people just want to talk about this. And so at some point in the last 2 years, I can't exactly remember when, but it seemed clear that it was time to write a book on it, because Star Wars helps me order my life a little bit better, and it seems to be the thing that can help a lot of others as well.
The subtitle of the book, How the Force Can Fix the World, is Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. There's a question here that I had when I first heard the subtitle, which was, I'm not sure this story is actually all that happy. And I'm not sure that George Lucas intended for this story to be all that happy. Certainly when you see the prequels, it seems like he wanted to set up this Faustian bargain that had been maintained. How do you find happiness in a story that, if you step back from it and take it seriously, as opposed to viewing it as a collection of children's movies or a collection of myths set in the stars, that how do you find happiness within a story that contains such a destructive arc for so many of the characters?
Yeah, so people who live in Star Wars are just constantly in this cycle of order, chaos, and war after war after war. It would not be Star Wars unless we had wars to talk about. But this is also the nature of the real world as well, which is that we're always sort of passing between periods of relative calm into periods of disorder. I grew up in the 90s, for example, and we all like to talk about the relative political peace and societal calm of the 90s, as opposed to when we cross over into the 2000s and we began the war on terror and the post 9/11 world and all that kind of stuff. So Star Wars is not necessarily telling us a story about characters pursuing happiness, but what it is teaching us in every single trilogy, whether it be the plight of Anakin Skywalker and his descendants into Darth Vader, and then Luke Skywalker, his son, and even this heroine Rey in the new trilogy, is these characters learning how to master their own emotions, master their fear, and their sense of control in an uncontrollable world. I think essentially the primary message of Star Wars all goes back to when Anakin Skywalker was leaving home for the first time to go train as a Jedi. And he says to his mother, "I don't want things to change." And Shmi Skywalker says back to him, "You can't stop this. You can't stop the change any more than you can stop the sun from setting." And even just as soon as yesterday, I was looking online and one of my national conservative friends, sort of off to the populist right, literally had in their Twitter byline, "I am angry at the sun for setting." And it just sort of spoke to me about there are people out there who really do not like change.
Mm-hmm. I love the passage that you have in your chapter on redemption, where you talk about the current political climate here in America. You talk about a reckoning with the darkness that we have that has to result in balance and harmony. You write in part, "Look around you. We don't have peace. We don't have atonement. We don't have empathy. We don't have healing. Every time you turn on the news, some cartoon character, author, book, actress, or private citizen is being canceled, discontinued, fired, or destroyed, all in the name of accountability or justice for an amorphous group or to quiet a small but rowdy online mob. It's easy to say we just need to rediscover the virtue of forgiveness, but there's a blockage in our veins that makes even approaching the task of forgiveness a huge hurdle." You just to skip a bit, you write, "How did we become simultaneously so self-loathing and so arrogant?" I think it has something to do with how the social media era has allowed people to curate ideal versions of themselves to present to their peers. We can pick and choose what is seen. We filter our lives through sepia and Clarendon filters like you'd find on Instagram. At a certain point, it becomes easy to forget the not so great posts we might have made 10 years back. We start to believe our own distortions about who we are and forget about our brokenness. We're in the midst of a hubris pandemic." I think all of this is true. What does it have to do with Star Wars?
Well, that's a worthy question. And I do think that the message of Star Wars, the more that I looked into it, there's this sort of story at the end of nearly every trilogy where a character will pass away from life and sort of enter the afterlife, right? Like we see this in Return of the Jedi. Yoda dies, he becomes one with the Force. The same thing happened to Obi-Wan, and then it eventually happens to Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader. So Darth Vader, when he dies in Return of the Jedi, he becomes a Force ghost, his old self, Anakin Skywalker. What does that mean to you? Because when you talk to most Star Wars fans, they'll go, "Well, it's a redemption story. You know, he was saved, his soul was sort of redeemed, and he was brought back to the light." And that's all well and good. But there's also in the Judeo-Christian, you know, world that we live in, very much the society that we are operating in today, there's sort of an idea that there's also atonement here. You have to sort of be saved. You have to have a savior who is paying the debt for you. That's quite literally what you know, Christ's blood is meant to be in the Christian faith, is a payment on a debt that we can never fulfill. Who did Darth Vader pay? Well, he didn't really pay anyone. Star Wars derives its story on redemption and peace within the soul much more from the Hindu tradition and the work of psychologist Carl Jung, which sort of zeroes in on the lightness and darkness within all of us and reconciling the differences and walls between the two. In Star Wars, the call of someone who's going to become one with the Force is not to have a clean soul like you might have when you enter the kingdom of heaven, you know, in the Christian faith. It's to have reconciled that the light and the dark within you are both equal and opposite versions of yourself, both worthy of your recognition, and that they've learned to coexist without one dominating the other. That is what Star Wars' best characters do, your Obi-Wans, your Yodas, even your Darth Vaders. Darth Vader walks in the wilderness very much in the dark side for 20, 30 years, and then he chooses to not have that be the way that he's going to live anymore. He has seen the darkness, and then he's chosen not to be that person. And for Star Wars, Wars, that war between the Jedi and the Sith, the call towards balance is a call towards not being all of one or all of the other. That's really, really hard when you think about the way that our political culture is today, which sort of demands dualism and sort of a segregation of two sides of yourself in all senses. And that gets even worse when you talk about our secularizing society, where people don't believe in anything but themselves and anoint themselves as their own gods and saviors. That's one of the things that's plaguing young people today, particularly on the left.
They're expected to be a Jung invincible. I apologize, but I'm ching. The thing that sticks out to me about what you're trying to do with this book is how much it is a reflection on the increased demand for stoicism in a kind of anti-stoic age.
Yes.
Filtered through the lens of Star Wars, which is, I think, if you step back from it, a very stoic tale. In if you analyze kind of the best aspects of it and view it as being, as meaning more than just, you know, big budget entertainment, I think that's the lesson that you can take from it. And as you know, I'm someone who's very much a fan of finding these lessons within popular culture, because I believe that has enormous value, and that it is, you know, there is a line that extends back to the point where humans were drawing on the sides of caves. That goes through, you know, Gilgamesh and the Iliad and everything else like that until you get to Captain America. And to me, that's something that we shouldn't deny. We should accept that. And we should try to find, what lessons is this teaching us? And I think that, you know, when it comes to Star Wars, there's numerous lessons you can take from it. But one of them really is responsibility, denial of self, and the kind of stoicism that comes with that purpose. You know, the idea of Obi-Wan living out in the desert, forever, in terms of just waiting for what's going to come to him is very biblical in a sense.
Right. And, you know, Ben, we're a long way from the era of Odysseus sort of being the story that children tell to each other when they're looking for how to talk to each other about the trial of suffering and, you know, conquering dragons and crossing the ocean to face, you know, their fears. Like, we're a long way away from those myths being the common culture that we have and talk to each other about. And that's what this book is for. You had Ryan Holiday on your show just a couple of weeks ago, and he's sort of this, you know, modern day, filter for understanding stoicism in many senses. And I've learned a lot from listening to Mr. Holiday myself. And look, I mean, it goes back to the Greek Stoic Epictetus, and he was known to say that some things are in our control and some others are not. Things are in our control: our opinion, pursuit, desire, and our own actions. But things that are not in our control are body, property, and reputation. And this right here is a call for people to recognize that only they are accountable for their actions in a world where they cannot control the actions of others. You are responsible for your feelings. If someone has microaggressed against you, as some snowflake college student might say, it is your responsibility, not theirs, to be the master of what sort of feelings you feel, right? Like, what do you do with that reaction? That is what Star Wars is, in essence, all about: the light side and the dark side. The dark side calls on you in Star Wars to feel everything so that you can maximize your sense of pain and personal suffering, turn that into anger, and then pursue power. Whereas Jedi and the light side are calling on you to abstain from feeding feelings and to instead focus on logic and reason. You know, Yoda says to Anakin in episode 3, you need to train yourself to let go of all that you fear to lose. And the reason that he says that is because if you cannot train yourself to let go of things that you might love, then you're going to live a life of fear, where you're coveting those things and protecting them violently in some cases. And then you're going to descend into suffering. That's how it is. And you're a parent. That's sort of the life of a parent in many ways. Our love for our children is suffering every single day when we leave home. And that is a real tough part about being a person, being a human being and a parent. But it's something that we have to strive for, is finding our equilibrium in other sources.
I have to ask you about the consumption of anti-Star Wars analysis, which I think is also something that can actually be revealing and that you can take lessons from. And I'm speaking, of course, of the infamous Red Letter Media series on YouTube, something that got millions upon millions of views for analytical videos of the prequels that ran as long as the movies themselves, in some cases, critiquing the approach that George Lucas used and the story that he was trying to tell, mostly from a filmmaking perspective, but also from a character perspective as well, the choices that he made in casting, the different things that went into that. I'm curious, first of all, have you ever sat down and watched all of that? And if so, what did you think of it?
I have not sat down to watch all of that, but I sort of do have strong opinions about the critic class, even whether it be the professional class or the online hobbyists who have sort of turned it into a living.
Okay, so let me interject then. So I have watched, I don't know if the entirety of it, I think it's like 7 hours long if you watch all three of the videos that they made. And it rocketed this group of sort of schlubby Wisconsin critics into a new stratosphere of YouTube-based criticism. And it was also something that was quite funny at points. I'll tell you one thing that I did chortle at a bit, which is there's a point, I think, in their analysis of the series where it's mostly focused on the second one, obviously mostly focused on Attack of the Clones, where they just show every scene that consists of people either getting up from a couch or sitting down on the couch in order to have a conversation.
There was an amazing video I saw the other day that looked at how in episode 2, there's this plot to assassinate Queen Padme, and every villain passes the responsibility on to a different villain. Emperor Palpatine or Palpatine tasks Dooku to do it, and then Dooku tests Jango Fett, and Jango Fett hires his buddy to go do it, and they all fail.
It's the sort of thing where you just don't think about it. It's happening. It's flashy. It's, you know, there's lights and sounds. And the other thing that's amusing is, of course, they intercut the commentary tracks, which are from, it's basically Lucas doing one by himself and then a bunch of the other people doing one together. And the Lucas one just sounds completely bored and disengaged and is repeatedly sort of saying, well, we're just trying to explain the past scene to viewers because we don't think they've maybe really got it or some equivalent of that. So we have to do it again. My point is not to rag on Star Wars, but it is to point out there is a class of online critic who usually, as in the case of Red Letter Media, is a bunch of Star Trek fans who rag on Star Wars as being less serious, as being, they kind of accept the Disney-esque argument, though I don't think Disney would necessarily entirely advocate for this, that these are movies for children. They are built for children. They are meant to sell toys. They're meant to, you know, appeal to the younger folks among us. Don't read too much into them. Don't make the story too serious, because if you do, you're missing the point. You're trying to turn, you know, something that was written for children into some kind of deep philosophical experience. Now, personally, I reject that argument, but I'd like to hear you respond to it, because it's one that I think frequently crops up within the critic class.
Right. I mean, I think the idea is sort of silly that, you know, great myths of our entire human arc of history were not at some point for children. Mm-hmm. The Boy Who Flew Too High of Daedalus, and, you know, trying to escape King Minos's island of Crete, you know, and his son Icarus, who flew too close to the sun, melted and fell. The Minotaur, and also, again, King Minos and his awful, you know, maze on the island of Crete. These were stories that I learned about as a child, literally through an animated series, and that have been getting told now for thousands upon thousands of years. And based on the fact that I have never seen either a child wandering around a school with a Star Trek backpack or walked into a congressional office and seen phasers on the walls of congressmen instead of lightsabers, what story are people going to be telling 1,000 years from now? Is it going to be something about Picard, or is it going to be something about Darth Vader? How the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and Darth Vader is the most iconic version of that that has ever been told in our modern era. It's obviously clear to me that Star Wars is the more serious and longstanding story because it is able to be told to children and then understood differently as adults.
So I, first off, a strong letter to follow from Stephen Kent. The thing that I think you're right. And the way that I would put it is, I'm interested in Star Trek. I certainly have enjoyed many versions of it. But where I think it fails is that much of it is essentially a theater play set on a starship about human nature, and an inquiry into that, which can be interesting. Sometimes it's not as much, but I would compare it to something like, there's a joke about, you know, Isaac Asimov's writing, that every plot he has is just, you know, just a logic puzzle disguised as a plot. And that's what I feel like, you know, is so true of many of these hard science fiction things, or, you know, in the case of something like Twilight Zone, you know, it's some reflection on an aspect of humanity that's meant to be wrapped up in short order and works more like a teleplay. Whereas from my perspective, Star Wars, if you appreciate the narrative arcs and the character arcs that happen within it, does have a lot more in common with myth and legend, and certainly with the appreciation that we have for Greek and Roman tales, in the same way that, you know, many of the Disney movies that have had the most impact, I think, on people are essentially based on, you know, the classic fairy tales, or in some cases, you know, they're the Grimm's fairy tales type approach to things, where here is the lesson you ought to learn from this. And that, to me, has a deeper human impact because it has more in common with these stories that are not just philosophical debates that you might have in a college classroom, but they're more about the lessons that you learn from existence and from the stories that we tell each other that pass time.
I think that's 100% point on point there about, you know, the differences between these two stories and the utilities that they sort of have in our discourse. I do often think of Star Trek as sort of a Twilight Zone-esque sort of episodic series. I know it is more than that at this point, but that's sort of how I frame it. Whereas, you know, in Star Wars, you're following the tale of this great family, you know, someone who's basically like King Arthur, right? Assembling his knights of the round table and then sort of facing the forces of darkness. Mm-hmm. That's the Skywalker story over the course of 40 years since this story has been getting told. And I have no doubt it will be getting continued to be told here in 100 years down the line in some new format. But at the end of the day, like, the book that I wrote is not necessarily sort of this steel manning of Star Wars, right? It's more looking towards the world that we have and saying there are a lot of ways in which we are losing the essential fabric of what make us an interconnected people with a strong set of morals and virtues that we all actually share and can speak the same language. That's the purpose of religion in a society, is in many ways to give everybody the same sort of level playing field that they're playing on in terms of their ideas and their virtues. And I am a Christian myself. I would like to see more people go to church, but absent that happening at the flick of a magic wand, I would contend that it's not that bad for people to all be familiar with the story of Star Wars, as, you know, how things can go wrong in your life, even with good intentions, and how you shouldn't let your emotions and your desire to be a control freak you know, like some of the dark side characters of Star Wars lead you astray. You know, something that I just come back to all the time, and particularly today where social media is taking up so much space in our minds. Like even right now, I'm thinking about how many notifications I might have because I'm a social media addled, political writer. It's just part of my being now. But I have to remind myself of what Qui-Gon Jinn said to Obi-Wan Kenobi in Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. He says, keep your mind here and now in the moment where it belongs. And Obi-Wan responds to him, you know, Master Yoda said, we should be mindful of the future. And Qui-Gon Jinn goes back to him. He says, but not at the expense of the moment. And you don't have to go very far to get right back to Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor and Stoic, who was known to say, don't let your reflection on the whole sweep of life crush you. Don't fill your mind with all the bad things that might still happen. Stay focused on the present situation. And we need people who are telling us this. Otherwise, we're just out to sea with nothing to give us grounding in a world that is constantly changing. So Star Wars has done that for me, and I want to see it happen for more other people as well.
We'll have more with Stephen Kent right after this.
There's a line in Empire where Yoda tries to stop Luke from going and confronting Vader too early, essentially. And he says, if you choose the quick and easy path as Vader did, you will become an agent of evil. The quick and the easy is the type of thing that appeals to Americans today across the board. Everybody wants the quick and the easy. Mm-hmm. So how do you resist the pull of that? And I think that some people would say, well, what's so bad about the quick and easy?
Well, you know, you can even go back to Virgil's Aeneid, right? We're going back now thousands of years to where he writes Facilis Descensus Averno. That translates out to the descent to hell is easy. And that essentially could look at it a couple of different ways. And I think one of the main areas is that expediency does not build any sort of grit or sense of how to deal with adversity. You know, our strength and our moral courage comes from accomplishing great things and looking over great hurdles and then trying to find a way to get over them. I think it was actually your past guest, Ryan Holiday, who said, like, the obstacle is the way. If you don't have a dragon to slay, something great to do with your life, then you're really just going to tinker and stew and just sort of reflect on all the things that you want in life rather than going out there and getting it. And one of the just greatest sort of forms or sources of cultural decay that I look at today is just the access to instant gratification that we have in so many facets of our life, whether it be, and I appreciate Amazon sending me packages quickly. It's really, really great. But you lose something when you forget how to go to the grocery store and stand in a long line and just deal with the boring nature of existence, right? Like this is something that gives us a little bit of strength. And, you know, Ben, and you're a new father as well. And I'll share with you something that I remember teaching my daughter or bestowing upon her, I guess, when she was just a toddler, is you'll find yourself in a doctor's room waiting office, right? You're waiting in the lobby for your doctor appointment or the pediatrician. And there will be a couple of kids in there playing on their parents' phones because the parent will sort of hand something to them, be like, hey, you know, play Candy Crush or, you know, play Tetris or do something just so that you're not squawking. It's sort of the form of the modern pacifier. And you'll see it when you go out to eat dinner as well. When families are gathering around the table, they hand the kid the phone and then they stare down at it. I told my daughter this, you have got to learn to be okay and at peace alone with your thoughts. Mm-hmm. Once you have gotten to the point where you are okay sitting alone with your thoughts, I will let you use my phone. Mm-hmm. It's been 10 years now. And when I drive up down, you know, to North Carolina to go visit my family, it's about a 5-hour drive. My 10-year-old daughter sits in the back seat and stares out the window and watches the world pass her by for 5 hours, you know, that because she's just thinking, right? Mm-hmm. We lose the ability just to sit and think about things when we're constantly pacifying our need for stimuli. And that's going to be a big challenge for all of the people in your audience who are going to become parents or who are looking to change their own habits as well.
Mm-hmm. What is a singular moment in the Star Wars story that you think people ought to pay more attention to that perhaps has been lost as something of significance from your perspective?
Well, I think at the end of the day, my greatest struggle as a person of faith has always been the mantra of letting go and letting God. Mm-hmm. My mom has said it to me for as long as I can remember, honey, you've got to let go and let God. You've got to pray on this decision that you've got ahead of you. And I would always find myself indignant and sort of standoffish about the idea that my plans and my accomplishments and the things that I'm shooting for, that when the door has opened to me, that I should pause and pray about it. The idea that like all of my work, that I need to sort of seek an outside source for an invisible sign or a silent voice in the night to tell me to go do this thing. I've always just sort of balked at it, and I struggle greatly with it. And I try every single day now to pray intently when I have a decision that I need to make and hope that I hear back from the big man upstairs in some way, shape, or form. And I always will now go back to the Death Star as one of the areas in which I understand this, where Luke Skywalker in the original Star Wars is tasked with taking that impossible shot against the Death Star's main reactor. They were not kidding in Star Wars when they said, no person can make this shot. And Luke, you know, sort of wrote it off as, you know, it can't be any different than shooting womp rats back on Tatooine. Well, that's not correct at all. It actually just was a mathematically impossible thing to do. And so they have targeting computers on their X-wings. And when he's going down that trench run and he's taking aim and he's about to fire, he hears the voice of Obi-Wan Kenobi telling him, Luke, let go. You've got to let go. And it goes back to when he was training with a lightsaber and trying to do it blind, right? There's a huge benefit to just sort of letting go of control in life and accepting that maybe there is a higher power out there who's going to help you and who's going to lead you along the way to conquering the things that you need to conquer. And Luke lands that shot, but it wasn't really Luke. It was the Force. Mm-hmm. It was the Force's will for that shot to land. And that's never going to happen unless you turn off your targeting computer in your life and you let go a little bit and just sort of see how things unfold.
Is this in some ways and you make reference later in the book to the dark side of determinism. Is this to some degree a misunderstanding of what our relationship ought to be with free will?
I mean, a little bit. I think the free will subject is just completely fascinating. I wasn't originally going to have a chapter on it in my book, but I was just moving towards submitting the final manuscript. And it just sort of dawned on me that there was this sort of chasm in my book that dealt with the aspect of choice, particularly in the instance of Rey and sort of choosing her own identity as a character in the Disney trilogy, whether or not she was going to live out her life as an heiress of Palpatine, or if she was going to take on the mantle of Skywalker. And the more I researched this subject of free will, it's almost as if I actually began to doubt it even more. I mean, if you go down the determinist rabbit hole, the idea that we either live in a simulation, which cannot be proven or disproven, just sort of how belief in God cannot be proven or disproven naturally, you know, you can eventually convince yourself of just about anything, that all of our actions in life are the result of one domino falling after another. This is something that Kylo Ren dealt with in the new Star Wars trilogy as well, sort of this feeling that, you know, his feelings and his past and his future were not his own, that he was sort of hostage to being the heir of Darth Vader. And when he started to hear voices in his head as a young man, he started to believe that he was just sort of destined to be the heir of Darth Vader and go down the dark path. And he did, but he didn't realize that he was actually being manipulated in the whole course of affairs. What I learned was that free will is entirely governed by what we ingest as people. It kind of goes back to social media a little bit. If I don't have a Twitter account, then I don't have to contend with the distraction of Twitter notifications when I'm trying to enjoy a dinner with my wife or just sitting here talking with you. If I am not a smoker, I do not have to contend with my voice in my mind telling me you need to go outside in the middle of your child's basketball game and have a smoke and you need to do it now. Mm-hmm. When you make bad choices, when you ingest things that are trying to occupy space in your mind, you are giving up your free will. Your free will is absolutely determined on your range of perception about the amount of choices that you can make in any given time. This is why Jedi abstain from romantic relationships. they abstain from romantic relationships for the same reason the Dalai Lama might, is because when you attach yourself to a person in that way, when you have a decision to make, your decision is going to be constrained to how it affects that person who you're romantically involved with, because that's what people who are in love do. It clouds your judgment. It's not bad to love. Love lifts us up to live great lives, but it is also part of living a painful life. Love and pain go hand in hand. So that's my sort of long drawn out way of saying, yes, like I believe in free will and Star Wars believes absolutely in free will, but you lose it the more that you indulge your vices and the things in life and in capitalism and in markets and all this stuff that are competing for your thoughts and your attention at all times.
If there's one thing that you would say to recommend your book to people who are looking to make purchases for this holiday season as a gift for those in their life, who do you think is the kind of person who ought to get this book, the kind of audience that might be particularly receptive to it and to the lessons that it contains?
This book is for the politically exhausted majority of this country. This book is for everybody out there who turns on the news or is looking out their window at a country and at a world which they hardly recognize anymore and that they are made nervous by. It is okay to admit that everything that's going on in the world and in our culture right now is incredibly anxiety inducing. This book is about finding a source of strength among hopefully other sources of strength. I hope all of you are out there going to church, but for those of you who are not, there are other places from which we can derive wisdom for which to live our lives and deal with those anxieties of a world dealing with pandemic, radical politics, and all these things which are making us feel like we live in unstable times. So it's for those people. And I happen to believe almost everybody out there knows who Darth Vader is. So it's for the casual fan and the super fan alike, but mostly just the concerned citizen.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. And I wish you the best of luck with How the Force Can Fix the World.
May the force be with you, Ben.
I know that by now you've probably seen the news that Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has decided to move on from the Build Back Better plan, the agenda pushed for by President Joe Biden. To me, this is something that was very predictable and you could see coming from a mile away. It's really a sign of how poor Joe Biden is as a negotiator, that he was ever in this space to begin with. But now that Manchin has made public that he really is officially moving on, that he's done, he hasn't been able to find a path to becoming in favor of this legislation, I think it's time to let's take a step back and appreciate how Biden's approach basically on this and on COVID are virtually the same, which amounts to him and his employees at the White House, his fellow staffers and the like, essentially just saying, hey, come on, man, just do what we tell you to do. That's not a very savvy strategy when it comes to dealing with U.S. senators, particularly very powerful ones like Joe Manchin. But it's also not a good strategy for dealing with COVID and the country. Reminds me of this incident that happened ages and ages ago in South Park, where Jimmy and Timmy, two of the comedic characters, essentially ended gang war by just standing in the midst of a group of gang members and saying, I mean, come on. It's not a strategy that works in the real world, yet it's been the approach that Biden has basically been deploying all along. This past week, Jeff Zients, who's the head lead on the White House's COVID response team, and again, it's supposed to be someone who's at the key part of communicating the message to the people about how they ought to think about this, along with Anthony Fauci and Rochelle Walensky at the CDC, he came out with this statement that just shocked me, that in terms of how blunt and bullying it was. He said, "We are intent on not letting Omicron disrupt work and school for the vaccinated. You've done the right thing, and we will get through this. For the unvaccinated, you're looking at a winter of severe illness and death for yourselves, your families, and the hospitals you may soon overwhelm." In other words, you know, good people over here, congratulations on being good, and bad people over here, you're very, very naughty and bad, and we anticipate that you soon will die. This is not the type of approach that anybody would really use if they were trying to convince more people to be vaccinated. They'd be emphasizing a return to normalcy that, of course, now does not seem to be on the, in the offing. Keep in mind that the CDC found, finally made public this week, the fact that they have been dramatically overcounting the number of people who they believe to be fully vaccinated. They haven't been tracking the shots correctly, and so they may be significantly undercounting, to the tune of millions, the people who have not actually been fully vaccinated. Even with the CDC's numbers that we had before, in states like Georgia, only about half of the population has been vaccinated. So if you're in a situation like this, you need to be convincing, doing your best, putting your best foot forward in order to try to convince people to go along with you, and not just badgering them or calling them idiots for not doing what you want them to do. This agenda, this BBB agenda that really has crashed and burned, seems like a horrible way for Joe Biden to end his first year in the presidency. And it's hard to see how he bounces back from this with an agenda that's going to change the direction of his party's political fortunes headed into next year's midterms. That's going to be something that we have to monitor and pay attention to. But really, I don't know what the White House is going to do next. They've already put out these nasty statements accusing Manchin essentially of lying to them, though I don't think that that is actually going to convince anybody, and along with, you know, a bunch of other angry statements from Capitol Hill members on both the House and Senate side about his approach to this. But, you know, Manchin is representing the citizens of his state, a state that went strongly against Joe Biden when it came to the presidency, and he has their priorities in mind. That's what you always have to think about in these moments. There really is, I think, a lack of appreciation that most politicians do have the representation of their people at the center of their priority list. Manchin is no different in that respect. And getting him to that point would have required taking a number of steps, a number of key steps that he made public months and months ago, that would have dramatically changed the agenda in ways that would have made it more palatable for his voters. And that would have given them more things to seek out and to look for as being advantageous within it. Instead, the Biden White House stuck to this leftward pitch that they've been making, this along with the priorities of a number of other progressives, particularly on the energy front, in ways that would have raised energy costs, would have probably made inflation worse, and certainly didn't give Joe Manchin any kind of out that would have led him to the point of saying, "This is something I've got to get behind." Politics is the art of persuasion, and that includes working with people who you may not like, who may not have your same priorities, in order to convince them to come along with you. This White House just doesn't seem interested in doing that, either for members of Congress or for the American people. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
from the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.